So we are entering into the season of Advent, and I think as Chris mentioned, so this is the first week, and then we'll bookend it on the Christmas weekend, which Christmas lands on Sunday this year. And so what we're going to do is we're going to gather on Christmas Eve. We're going to be at the Santa Stefano's house, and it's going to be potluck. We'll eat. We'll have a Christmas Eve liturgy and just be together. And so I think it'd be really nice. But just to gauge a show of hands, who will actually be around that weekend? Okay. So some of you. So for the handful that are, I think we'll get an invite out, and then we'll get food to be brought, and then we'll hang out together. All right? And so as we begin the season of Advent, every season we like to do something that I think is quite countercultural to how the West tends to do Christmas. And as everyone gets busier, we try to slow down. As people want to do more, we try to do less. And it's historically this time in the season where it's awaiting and anticipation. And we remember the first waiting, when they were waiting for Christ to come. And then we gather with communities who for centuries wait collectively for Christ to return again. And so we thought that just to set the tone for this season, what we wanted to do this morning is to spend some time in Lectio Divina, which is the praying of the scriptures. If you've been in midweek groups, you're familiar with that. And so we're going to spend some time doing it. But before we do, I'll just set up the context of the passage that we'll be in. All right. So the opening question was, what do you, you know, if you were to ask your neighbor, so I think most of us live in Austin. If you were to just go knock on your neighbor's door and ask, hey, what do you think of the church? What do you think they might say? Any thoughts? What was that? Church is mean, okay? Irrational, judgmental, hypocritical, out of touch, professes to love Jesus but doesn't love others. And I think that's interesting. And I think that would be the case, that if we were to knock on doors, that a lot of the responses often wouldn't be positive. But I remember reading this story, Philip Yancey tells it, and there was this church on the south side of Chicago, and one day this a woman who's a prostitute wanders in, and she's devastated and sobbing and can barely talk. And then through sobs, she tells this church worker that she's been renting out her 2-year-old daughter to men interested in kinky sex. And she, you know, is wailing and kind of unloads this all. And then she tells him that, you know, she does this because she can make more in an hour with her than she can all night herself. And she does it to support her drug habit. And so she's laying all this out there. And so the guy's flustered and doesn't really know what to say. And then he just kind of spits out, well, have you thought about going to church? And her response was this look of horror. Like, she's like, church, are you kidding me? Like, I already feel bad enough about myself. Why would I want to feel worse? And I think, you know, a lot of times when we talk to people in our neighborhoods, even I think in our minds when we hear the church, it's not necessarily a positive thing. And the text that we have this morning that the lectionary gives us, where Paul's writing to the church in Corinth, and this is how he starts. He says, every time I think of the church, I give thanks. And I think it's interesting, this disparity that we have. And so this morning, as we enter into this text and we're going to pray through the text, I kind of want to just ask that question. You know, why, in light of, you know, what most people think of the church, why was Paul thankful for it? You know, I think instinctively a lot of us will say, well, Paul's writing to the first century church and the early church got it right. And so he's thankful for that. And now we've kind of spiraled the other way. But if you read the letter, the rest of the letter, Paul talks to a church that has divisions. There's a lot of infighting. Some people are trying to follow Apollos. Other people are trying to follow Paul. People are visiting with prostitutes. People are sleeping with their mother-in-law. They had their fair share of problems. And then Paul goes, every time I think of this community, I'm thankful. And so I just wanted to give us some context as we walk through it. And then we'll spend some time meditating and praying through the text. So if you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians 1. We have it on the screens. Read verse 4 to 9 aloud to each other. And then I'll set it up a little bit before we go through. All right. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 4 through 9. Good. All right. And so this morning, the goal is just to pause, and especially in the busyness of Thanksgiving and Christmas, and to really set the tone for the season, to create space, to listen, to wait, to invite the Holy Spirit to come in, to open our hearts. And we're going to spend some time meditating through this, but I just wanted to give us a little more context, all right? So he starts off, and then in verse 4, he says, I always thank my God for you because of his grace given you in Christ Jesus. And then he says this, verse 5, for in him you have been enriched in every way. So he's saying, I thank God for you because of grace that's been given. And he says, I'm thankful because I look across this community and he says, it's rich. Like it has all the resources it needs. You know, a lot of commentators say Corinth was a wealthy city. It was a financial center. You know, they were living in a really affluent culture and neighborhood. I think maybe a parallel today would be like maybe New York City. My brother-in-law lived in New York City. He said middle class in New York City is 110,000. My sister lives in Hong Kong, which is a pretty, you know, it's a financial center, pretty affluent. Starter homes. So they're both medical doctors. After 15 years of being doctors, they are now able to buy their house. A starter home starts off at 1.5 million. And so if you live in affluent cultures like that, I think it's really easy to feel like you don't have enough resources. And Paul's now speaking to this community and says, you know what? You have all the resources you need like at your disposal. You may not necessarily understand the resources, but you have access to everything you need. You know, maybe it's like, so I think Chris alluded to it. So yesterday there was a lockout that ended. So no one really cares. Some of you care. So NBA players, lots of money, owners, even more money, have been fighting. And then as of yesterday, they decided to stop fighting, right? So does anyone care? Who cares? Okay, some of you do. Who doesn't? Okay. Who's just angry? And every lockout, I find a couple things interesting. One, I find it astounding how quickly world-class chiseled athletes stop becoming world-class chiseled athletes. Like suddenly the chisel becomes not chisel. Like abs become a belly. I think they call it the Sean Kemp syndrome. I don't know if you remember Sean Kemp. So Sean Kemp might have been the most athletic player in the history of the NBA, and within a short few months became the least athletic player in the history of the NBA. So there's all these like bets going around who's going to be the Sean Kemp of this lockout. So that's one thing I always find astounding. Then the other one is how quickly these people like feel a lack of resources and their money runs out. So there's this guy named Delonte West. I got the picture. So he plays, I don't know if he still has a contract with the Boston Celtics. But when the lockout was first announced, I think he tweeted this. He's going to start filling out an application at Home Depot. So this guy made $1 million last year. Over 7 years, he's made $14 million. And I think we could argue that with Delonte West, it's not a matter of like the amount of resources he has. I think you could argue that maybe it's his understanding or his usage of the resources. And what Paul is saying to the community that he was talking to in Corinth, they were in an affluent culture. A lot of the church members didn't have as much. And he was saying, you have everything you need at your disposal. It's there. You don't need anymore. You know, I'm reminded of the story of my namesake, Gideon. So the story goes like this. His name was Jerubbaal. They were being oppressed by a neighboring country. They were taking all his food. The story starts out, he's in a cave hiding his food so that they wouldn't take it. And then this angel shows up and says, hey, I've heard the cry of your people, and you're going to be released from the bondage of these people taking your food and enslaving you. And Gideon's like, that's great. And then the angel goes, but it's going to be you. And Gideon's like, I can't because I'm weak. Look at my guns. I have no guns. My family had no guns, like, you know, like arm guns. Is that what they're called, arm gun? And then so finally the angel convinces him. And then Gideon goes, okay, just make it clear to me that you want me to do this. So he's like, got a plan. I'm going to put up this cloth. It's going to be like a ShamWow, right? Put it on in the morning. And then if you really want me to do this, soak this thing, just drench it, and then let the rest of the ground be dry. So he goes to sleep, wakes up, and then it's soaked. He's like, ShamWow, right? All this wow, all this water coming out. And then he goes, don't be angry with me. If I'm really supposed to be the one that's going to do this, then just do the opposite. Like, make the ShamWow dry and then the ground wet. And then in the morning, it happens. And then now they're supposed to go face this neighboring country that's been oppressing them. They start with 32,000 men. And then God goes, this is perfect. You have all you need. And then Gideon's like, I don't know. Like, we're still kind of outnumbered. God's like, this is okay. Do this. Just go, hey, if any of you are scared, go home. He's like, I can't do that. Are you kidding me? We're already outnumbered. Like, they're going to leave. Just do it. He's like, okay. So God told me, if any of you are scared, you should go home. They're like, sweet, I'm gone, right? So 22,000 men leave. And Gideon's like, that's a terror, like the worst idea ever. And then God goes, okay, you have all you need, and maybe it's still too much, but I'm going to be with you. So do this. Go down. Let's go down. Let everyone have a drink. Now, there's 10,000 people. So imagine 10,000 of them go down to drink. And God basically says this. Now, everyone who drinks like a normal human being, tell them to leave. Everyone who drinks like a dog, we'll keep them, right? And then so like out of 10,000, 300 start lapping like dogs. And God's like, perfect. And then in the story, God's like, hey, I'm with you. You have everything you need. And Paul writes to this community, you've been enriched in every way. It may not seem like much, but it's all you need. And it's enough. And he says, I give thanks because you've been enriched in every way with all kind of speech and knowledge. God is confirming this testimony about Christ among you. Then he keeps going. And then he says this. And then therefore, because you've been enriched, he says, you do not lack any spiritual gift. And I like this picture of a gift, right? So imagine now that we all have a box with a bow on it, right? And it's been gifted to you. So you didn't pay for it, someone just gave it to you. And then I like the kind of the parallel definition of a gift, because a gift is also like a skill. So picture this, whatever skill, whatever craft, whatever passion that God's given to you. Now put that in a box, and now it's a gift. And Paul's saying, I'm thankful. Because I think if he imagines the potential of if everyone receives whatever gift that is, and then imagine if you use it and then you grow it, you become better at it, and then you give it away. Like, that's a beautiful picture. That whatever gift, if it's music, if it's mercy, if it's hospitality, if it's service, if it's counseling, whatever that gift is in a box, and then use it, grow it, and then give it away. You know, if you see gifted people and they don't use their gift, it's sad, right? You see someone who has all this potential and then it's devastating. They just waste it. But then on the flip side, if you see someone who's immensely gifted and then they work at it and they grow it, it's a really beautiful thing. Check out this quote.
Shane is very finely tuned. It's a bit like a Formula One car. It just needs that exact perfect body function and biomechanics in order to perform at the optimal level. So you need to be very accurate and very specific with him.
He's going so fast now, he's got to the point where the motorbike can no longer go any faster safely on the velodrome, and he's right on the back of that motorbike, you know, pushing it upwards, you know, towards 80 kilometres per hour.
The Olympics in 2012, that's going to be Perko's grand final. And we need to have this machine well-oiled. And we've had 2 years of good data now behind Perko, so we know exactly what he responds to and what works and what doesn't.
Bottom line, Shane's a machine built for power. At maximum output, he pushes 2,500 watts through his pedals. That's more than four times the power the average male can generate. It's enough to run 12 flat-screen TVs. If he spent the day in bed, his body would go through more calories than yours does in a normal day up and about. At peak heart rate, Shane pumps blood with more pressure than petrol through a Bowser.
We virtually train our body to absolutely get the maximum out of it when we call on it. Instead of winding up, it needs to just go bang.
It takes an enormous amount of effort and discomfort to reach that kind of speed, because of, you know, the amount of lactic acid that you've produced. Shane is operating right at that jagged edge where he's having to tolerate the kinds of symptoms that would turn most people off the sport.
In the rest of the clip, it goes on to talk about how, like, he puts himself into so much pain. Sometimes he wants to go to the bathroom on the bicycle, or he curls up in pain on the ground, right? And then, which is, you know, he's gifted physically, and then he's maximizing the gift of his physicality. But if you think about it, dude's just kind of riding around in circles over and over again. Like, that's it. He's not even going anywhere. It's like the same circle, right? But the intensity and the intentionality of becoming better. And I imagine Paul looks at this, you know, humble little community in Corinth, and it was a city known not just for wealth, but for craftsmen and artisans and artists. And then he looks across and sees the potential of gifts that can be grown, developed, and given away. And I look across our community and imagining, like, the full potential of whatever that gift that's been given in a box, and then used, and then grown, and then given away. And I think it would be a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so Paul says, you know, I'm thankful because you've been enriched in every way. You don't lack any spiritual gift. And then he keeps going, and then he finishes with this. He says basically that, not, you know, in the end, it's not that he's thankful because the community's awesome. He's thankful because he says that God will keep you firm to the end, and he will be faithful. That in the end, he's thankful not because the community is necessarily that great. Actually, he goes on for the rest of the letter. There's a lot of problems in the community. But that God will lead this community, and God will be faithful too. And it's as if these communities for centuries, and Vox as one of them, that we've now been invited into this score and this song and this symphony and this orchestra that God has been unveiling and playing through the centuries. And then now we just find our instrument and we find our chair, and then we play it to the best of our abilities, trusting that somehow there's orchestration to all. And I think, you know, all of us have been in a concert or we've watched a symphony, and you see instruments that alone are already beautiful. But then when they come together and there's a composer and there's a vision and there's a song to it, it's unbelievable. A couple years ago, Sufjan Stevens was in town and he played ACL. He did a taping, and then he also played the Paramount. And there was this one song where it builds up and builds up, and at the climax is so unbelievable and moving. Check out.
All the glory that the Lord has made, and the complications when I see his face in the morning and the evening. shook my face. Then he takes, then he takes, then he takes.
Played that at the Paramount, and you've got a auditorium filled with people in Austin, like skinny jean, bearded, like Austinites, and then him singing of the glory of when you took my place, and it comes to this climax with these beautiful instruments and the strings and the brass, and then he rings the bell, which is historically in worship services when it's the announcement of the sacred and the divine, and he's ringing this bell, and like the hair on the back of my neck is standing on end, and like tears are coming to my face, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And those instruments alone are amazing, but collectively with the song and the vision. And Paul's saying this church in Corinth has issues and it has problems and it's got things we're working on, but we've been invited with our gifts. We've been enriched in every way, and that God is faithful and God is orchestrating this. And we find our seat in our instrument and we play his song. And he's like, because of that, I give thanks.